Welcome, friend, to our historic hometown of Wabash. You are currently standing in the first electrically lighted city in the world. It's only one of many, many stories of innovation and inspiration. As you walk around the Wabash Cultural District, you will find that every brick and beam has stories to tell of trailblazers who forever changed America. Allow me to guide you through that journey. There are two ways to listen. You can walk and let me guide you downtown, or just simply listen. If you choose to walk, we will be walking for half a mile for about 30 minutes. It's all flat and at an easy pace. You will want to start on Market Street, across from the parking lot, under the alley walk sign that says Market. You can pause the audio now until you get there. As you stand downtown, imagine this entire area shrouded in complete darkness. Aside from the gentle moonlight, there is nothing else to illuminate the space. The year is 1880, and the few who are still out at a late hour only have the dying light of oil lamps to walk around the town. Now, look toward the Wabash County Courthouse, which is up the hill past the parking lot. Lift your head to the top. There you will see a display showing where the first ever Charles Brush arc lighting system was installed. This system could produce a glow equal to 3,000 candles in a single lamp. In the first ever demonstration of this for city use happened on March 31st, 1880. These streets were full of people waiting with bated breath for the four arc lights to come on. When they did, the downtown was flooded with bright white light, leaving everyone shocked and overwhelmed. This is what some reporters had to say, who are standing possibly where you are right now. Promptly as the courthouse clock struck eight, the thousands of eyes that were turned upward toward the inky darkness over the courthouse saw a shower of sparks emitted from a point above them. Small, steady spots of light, growing more brilliant, until within a few seconds after the first sparks were seen, it was absolutely dazzling. A loud shout went up from the crowd, and the band began to play. People stood overwhelmed with awe, as if in the presence of the supernatural. The strange, weird light, exceeded in power only by the sun, rendered the square as light as midday. Men fell on their knees. Groans were uttered at the sight, and many were dumb with amazement. We contemplated the new wonder in science, as lighting brought down from the heavens. Looking away from the courthouse and back down to the streets, you can imagine the crowds of people mesmerized by the spectacle, and how, in the days to come, men would gather to read their newspapers under a light that mimicked daylight, and how children could continue playing after the sun went down. If you face the parking lot again, looking toward the courthouse, we will now be going left with traffic. That is toward Miami Street. You'll see the Eagles Theater sign to your right. Let's start walking. And during this tour, you can keep a slow, comfortable pace. These lights, bright and steady, symbolized a new era, illuminating the potential of electric power and its capacity to transform everyday life. But more importantly, it offered safety and new opportunities for social and economic activities. As you can imagine, seeing the success of the arc light here in Wabash, other cities wanted the brush arc lighting system too. This lighting system provided higher quality light at one-third the cost of gas lamps, which made it the obvious choice. Continue straight, past this light at Miami Street, walking by Eagles Theater and Charlie Creek Inn. When you approach an intersection with a light during this tour, just pause and wait for instructions. Remember, take your time walking. The instrument that completely revolutionized city life was innovated by a man who spent his entire life on a farm 10 miles outside of Cleveland. As you walk around the cultural district of Wabash, think about how the lighting you enjoy every day was first brought here by Charles Brush, who started constructing simple electrical devices by himself at the age of 12. By 1881, major cities like New York, Boston, and San Francisco were illuminated by Brush's arc light systems. And you might ask, how could the arc lights suspended on top of the courthouse provide lighting over downtown? To answer this question, you need to know two things. One is the position of the courthouse being on top of the hill overlooking downtown square. And the other is how bright and how brilliant the Brush arc light is. Even still today, the Brush arc light is used in searchlights and movie theater projectors. The event in 1880, right here in Wabash, earned the city the title as the first city to be wholly lit by electric light. One of the very Brush arc lights used that night is also on display inside the courthouse. When you approach the next light at Cass Street, continue to walk straight. If I start to mention something during this tour that you haven't approached yet, simply pause the audio. Let's keep walking until you reach the Honeywell Center. Continue walking past this Honeywell Center sign on the corner and stop next to these small trees here on the sidewalk. If that name sounds familiar, it's because Mark Honeywell pioneered the first hot water home heating system. This groundbreaking invention not only warmed homes, but also hearts, symbolizing comfort and progress. When he was younger, Mark spent his time working odd jobs, including fixing up bicycles and working at his father's mill. He would go on to develop the first ever hot water home heating system in America, catapulting him to incredible success and giving him the opportunity to expand his horizons. Mr. Honeywell will go on to create and lead the Honeywell Corporation, the makers of the famous Honeywell thermostat, along with many other products and ventures. Mark Honeywell's influence extends to art, culture, and our community. And the manifestation of that is what you're looking at right now, the Honeywell Center. Mark formed the Honeywell Foundation, which is nonprofit, in 1941. He created it to memorialize his first wife, Olive, along with his parents. The Honeywell Center that you're looking at now was built during World War II and was officially dedicated in 1952. This place has not only been the venue for celebrating personal milestones and events for locals, but also plays host to many national plays and concerts, with artists like Willie Nelson, the Beach Boys, Chicago, Kenny Chesney, and Crystal Gayle gracing the stage. From art shows to educational events and so much more, this center has come to be associated with learning and cultural enrichment over the years. Now let's start walking back down Market Street, back the way we came. Continue through this light, here on Cass Street, next to the Honeywell Center. Speaking of Crystal Gale, this artist is another former resident of Wabash, and she went on to make history in the entertainment industry. Her name resonates with the sweet sound of country music and stirs the heart of so many around the world. Crystal was born Brenda Gale Webb on January 9, 1951, in Paintsville, Kentucky. Her family moved to Wabash when she was four to seek treatment for her father's black lung disease. Crystal's older sister, Loretta Lynn, wrote about their father supporting the family as a coal miner in her hit song, Coal Miner's Daughter. In fact, in the summers, Crystal often toured with Loretta. During one such summer, Loretta came up with her little sister's stage name, which was based on a Southern hamburger chain. While living here in Wabash, if you were a visitor at the Webb home, you were in for a very special treat. Crystal's mom recognized that she needed a bit of a push to get comfortable performing in front of people, so she would perform right there in the family room. At just 16, Crystal stepped into the Grand Ole Opry stage and covered Gordon Lightfoot's Ribbon of Darkness. The opportunity arose when her sister Loretta was supposed to perform, but talked the Opry into letting her sing in her place because she was sick. Crystal is now best known for her iconic 1977 hit, Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue, along with her iconic floor-length black hair. She was the first country female artist to achieve platinum status of a record, selling 1 million copies, and she was the first female country artist to perform in China. With 22 number one country hits, 5 Academy of Country Music Awards, 2 Country Music Association Awards, 3 American Music Awards, and a Grammy, plus a 2017 induction into the Grand Ole Opry, it cements her status as a country music legend and acknowledges how Wabash's people and culture of curiosity and innovation touches every industry. When you get to the light on Miami Street, cross the intersection and make a quick right. Stop here in front of Modoc's Coffee Shop for a moment. Crystal and Loretta weren't the only talented ones in their family either. Their sister Peggy Sue lived here in Wabash as well. Peggy Sue was working at a local manufacturing company in 1966 called General Tire. When she started writing a song in the cafeteria on her breaks. That song, Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' With Lovin' On Your Mind, would go on to become Loretta Lynn's first number one country hit. Now you might have noticed by now, there are small statues of small elephants all around on the sidewalk. And you might be asking, Shane, what is all of this about? Well, on November 11th, 1942, the Great American Circus was in town to perform at Wabash High School. Great American's Special Animal Act featured 3 great Indian elephants, Judy, Empress, and Modoc, who were waiting on this day outside the school gym, waiting for their time to perform. Suddenly, dogs started barking, which spooked the elephants, causing them to run. Empress and Judy were found in nearby neighborhoods, but the 1,900-pound Modoc charged here to downtown Wabash. Right here, in fact, to this very building, where she picked up the smell of peanuts roasting inside the Bradley Brothers drugstore. She chased an innocent passerby into the store's door, rolling her onto the floor, scaring the clerk behind the soda fountain counter to death. Modoc knocked over the peanut roaster, scarfed up her fill of peanuts, and then smashed through the back door, frame and all. She came back out here to the sidewalk and then crossed over to Market Street, poking her head into Union Cigar Store, which is now Market Street Grill. For the next 5 days, Modoc fled. The Wabash Plain Dealer, along with other newspapers across the country, reported on Modoc crisscrossing the Wabash River. She ran from farm to farm, eventually ending in Huntington County. After a long chase and mix of strategies, finally a Carolina circus trainer lured Modoc into her trailer, chanting an elephant tune, and 26 loaves of bread. Now, let's continue walking down Miami Street toward Canal Street. Today we have Google Maps to find absolutely any shop or building in our downtown. Or we have guided tours, like the one you're listening to right now. But in the not-so-distant past, all we had were the Yellow Pages. So, as you explore this vibrant downtown, it's a good time to talk about the creator of the Yellow Pages, Lorne M. Berry. Some of the buildings in downtown Wabash have the inscription Plain Dealer. You might have seen some already. This emblem serves as a portal to the past, when Lorne M. Berry walked these very streets before an idea came to him. Lorne Berry's father passed away when he was only 4 years old, so his mother, who was a woman of many talents, including being a maternity nurse and a seamstress, worked day and night to support Lorne and herself. Luckily, Lorne showed entrepreneurial spirit quite early on. At 8, he started selling homemade horseradish and later managed newspaper and laundry routes. During his high school years, he dabbled in journalism as a reporter for the Wabash Plain Dealer and honed his business skills as the sports editor and business manager of his school's publication, where he first experienced selling advertising space. Now let's make a left at Canal Street. You'll see another light at this intersection. And it was during his time selling advertising for interurban railroad timetables that Lorne's path took a turn. The manager of a telephone company noticed his talent and offered him a chance to sell advertising space in their directory. This opportunity sowed the seeds for his future empire. In 1910, Lorne, along with his wife Lucille, took a leap of faith and moved to Dayton, Ohio. There, on a tight budget, they launched the Ohio Guide Company, initially focusing on printing timetables. Lorne quickly identified the potential in Yellow Pages and shifted his focus in developing a telephone directory operation. He called this venture L. M. Berry Company, and it blossomed into a nationwide business, becoming a leading telephone directory publisher in the United States, responsible for one in every four directories. In time, he expanded his operations globally, where his directories were known as the Golden Pages. In 1986, Bell South Corp. bought his company, with estimates suggesting the deal exceeded $1 billion. The Berry Company continued under this new ownership, managing over 800 directory titles and serving an incredible network of telephone companies and advertisers. And so throughout his career, Lorne was affectionately dubbed Mr. Yellow Pages. His vision was a symbol of connectivity and accessibility, one of the first instances of the democratization of information. The Yellow Pages made it possible for anyone, from homemakers to entrepreneurs, to access a wealth of services and opportunities with a simple flip of a page. So today, as you walk by all these buildings, once associated with the Wabash Plain Dealer, know that you are walking through the very cradle of this transformative idea. You'll find a large building on the corner of Canal and Wabash Street that has this name on it, right above the door. Now we are at the corner of Wabash Street and Canal Street at the light. Turn around and look at Canal Street, the street you just walked on. On March 2, 1827, Congress provided a land grant that allowed for the building of the Wabash and Erie Canal. It was the longest canal ever built in North America, and it ran from Toledo, Ohio to Evansville, Indiana. Work began on the canal in 1832, and around 1836, the canal ran right here. The train tracks behind the set of buildings to your left is where the canal set. Goods would arrive here on the canal and then be taken off and carted into these buildings. The canal that ran through here was about 4 feet deep and about 40 feet wide. The canal not only brought goods to Wabash, it brought people. Vastly expanding the population, suddenly more businesses opened up downtown. More buildings were built, and more people enjoyed the offerings of this bustling canal town. By 1900, the railroad would render the canal obsolete. It could move goods and people much faster and cheaper. And so the canal here was filled in, covered up, and a railroad was placed on top of it. Wabash continued to thrive with the railroad. You could hop on a train right here in the morning and arrive in Toledo or Chicago by evening. At this time, these dirt roads were also being paved, and the new interurban was also installed. This electric tram would stop right here, in front of this building, in fact, as its last stop each night downtown. Now let's turn back to the light. Walk straight through this light, crossing over Wabash Street, and turn left. During this tour, if you saw a restaurant you liked and wanted to make a reservation for later today or anytime soon, you'd likely have to call them. But the ease of which we make these calls today, often taking for granted the simplicity of dialing a number and instantly connecting, can be credited to the Costas Loop. Invented by John P. Costas, another person who called Wabash home. The Costas Loop is a phase-locked loop-based circuit that clarifies the message it carries by demodulating a carrier signal and recovering the information at the other end. This information forever changed communication systems, making it possible to use telephones and mobile phones the way we do. Simply put, when you make a phone call, your voice is converted into an electronic signal that needs to be transmitted over long distances. This signal carries both amplitude and phase information, which can easily get distorted due to noise and other interference during transmission. But what the Costa Loop does is remarkable. It locks onto the phase of the received signal so it can accurately demodulate it. This process ensures that the information carried over the communication channels, like telephone lines or cellular networks, is correctly reproduced at the receiving end. And without this technology, you wouldn't have quite as much efficiency in making work calls or making restaurant reservations. At this light on Market and Wabash Street, turn right. Do not cross the intersection. We will be walking straight for 2 blocks until you reach the park. Keep walking until the sidewalk ends. Now, if you happen to come across any antique shops, like the one up the hill on Wabash Street at Brimso's Antiques, I do recommend popping in and browsing through their catalog. You can find some rare and interesting gems. But if you're lucky, you might also chance upon a poster of an iconic female figure in Wabash history, Margie Stewart. Earlier, I mentioned the story of Modoc the Elephant. Well, if that year in 1942 sounded familiar to you, America had just recently entered World War II after the attack on Pearl Harbor. When the Great American Circus was here in town, they announced it would be their last event until the end of the war, because so many circus hands were heading off to war. That was happening everywhere. In fact, it happened to more than 16 million Americans. So, the U.S. Army was seeking a relatable, yet inspiring figure to feature in their morale-boosting posters. And Margie Stewart, with her girl-next-door appeal and genuine aura of warmth, was the perfect choice. She became the official U.S. Army poster girl, a role that saw her image grace an array of posters and publications distributed to millions of soldiers and civilians alike. Stewart's posters became a source of comfort for the nation and a reminder of what the soldiers were fighting for, the everyday joys and freedoms of American life. Her image became synonymous with the American spirit, embodying the resilience and hope of a nation at war. As you take in all that these buildings and stores have to offer, think about the impact her posters had on the people fighting for this country. Each of her 94 million copies carried with it a piece of Wabash, a reminder to the soldiers of the life and love awaiting them back home. Her presence provided a sense of normalcy, a glimmer of peace amidst the chaos of war. Her contribution was maybe quite unconventional, but it was profound. Margie Stewart's role as the poster girl also broke barriers and set a precedent for the representation of women in military communications, showcasing their role in the war effort, both on the home front and in support roles. Before you leave the Cultural District today, I recommend walking or driving to the Wabash County Courthouse. Not only will you see the building that the arc lights were installed on, out front you will find a statue of Abraham Lincoln, and you'll also find a monument dedicated to those in Wabash County who gave their lives and who served in World War I, World War II, Vietnam, and Korea. By now, you should be approaching Paradise Spring. A small circle of about a dozen log cabins here marks the spot of an 1826 treaty between the Potawatomi and Miami Indian Nations and the U.S. government. Feel free to stand here and observe, or walk the trail to the cabins during this part of the tour. If you'd like to sit down, there are some picnic tables ahead under the pavilion, next to the cabins. One of the cabins belonged to the governor of Indiana, and another, the governor of Michigan. Other dignitaries and military officers filled the remaining cabins. 2 years earlier, in 1824, the Fall Creek Massacre had put the entire region on alert, and both sides were eager to avoid more violence. Directly south of here, in current-day Pendleton, Indiana, men, women, and children of the Seneca and Miami tribes were brutally murdered by white settlers. For the Native Americans, there was no tension between the two groups. They wanted only to hunt and reassured the settlers of their peaceful intentions. The same could not be said for the settlers. Under the pretense of looking for a lost calf, the settlers led the men of this hunting party into the woods and slaughtered them. Then they went into the natives' camp and killed the women and children. Four of the children were under 10 years old. When news spread of this massacre, the American public was horrified. So horrified that four of the murderers became the first ever white men in American history, sentenced to death for crimes against Native Americans. 2 years later, in 60 miles north, the Treaty of the Mississinewa was signed right here in Wabash. And for a brief moment in time, peace was possible. The Treaty of the Mississinewa spared countless lives along the frontier. And had it never happened, Wabash may not be here today. The name of this little neighborhood of cabins is known today as Paradise Spring. Let's turn back on Market Street and start walking. Our final destination is in front of the Wabash County Museum. It is right before we get to the light on the right. While Margie Stewart provided hope and spirit to soldiers fighting in World War II, Howard A. Howe, another person from Wabash, was waging a different but equally crucial battle against polio. In a time when the world was grappling with the menace of this crippling disease, Howe's work in the medical field turned out to be crucial. His research and contributions toward the development of the polio vaccine was akin to fighting an invisible enemy that had long plagued humanity. Growing up in Wabash, Howe was nurtured in an environment that fostered curiosity and resilience. These qualities would later become key in his pursuit of medical research. His work was driven by a deep-seated desire to conquer polio, which had instilled fear and uncertainty in people, much like the war itself. Picture this. The year is around 1950, and Howard A. Howe is working with Yogi, a chimp. But this is no ordinary chimp. Yogi had developed such a robust immunity to polio after being exposed to the virus that he was no longer viable for studies at Johns Hopkins. That was the efficacy of Howe's research. Rewinding a bit, it was in 1937 that Howe initiated the original polio program at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. His leadership and expertise were so valued that he continued to direct the laboratory even after it moved to the School of Hygiene and Public Health in 1942. By the time of his retirement in 1959, Howe had risen to the role of adjunct professor of epidemiology. In 1942, 3 years before the end of World War II, Dr. Howe was awarded the E. Mead Johnson Award, given by the Society of Pediatric Research, and then named to the Polio Hall of Fame in 1958. In a key moment in 1952, just before pioneering inoculation programs of Dr. Jonas Salk, Howe successfully vaccinated all the children at the Rosewood State Hospital. Now make your way to the front of the Wabash County Museum. As you can tell by now, Wabash is not just a city of innovation. It is a place where dreams are nurtured and where ordinary people achieve extraordinary things. It's a city that has left an indelible mark, not only on its streets, but on the pages of history and the lives of countless people across the world. As we part ways, I hope you carry with you not just memories of this tour, but also the inspiration from the stories of Wabash's sons and daughters. I hope their achievements remind you that in every corner of this small yet remarkable city, there lies a story of perseverance, innovation, and the relentless pursuit of excellence. Thank you for joining me on this journey through the heart of Wabash and its historical cultural district. I invite you to go inside and visit the Wabash County Museum to further explore the history of the people you heard about and learn more about what our town has to share. You can also learn more about Wabash at the Wabash County Visitor Center next to MODOC's on Miami Street. I'm Shane Waters from the Hometown History Podcast. Thank you for listening.